language learner has joined us to give us a little bit of an update. So I know his time is precious at the moment. So if there are no hands, which I do not see any, we will go to you, language, if you are ready.
I'll probably be another moment just yet. I'm trying to set up the map here. I'm on a Starlink out here, Eastern Ukraine, and it's somewhat Eastern. I'm not going to, you know, not to be too obnoxious, but I'm not exactly going to give you my grid coordinates right now. It's in a fairly safe place. Like, I'm not exactly standing in Volchansk. So, but I will put the notes up in the nest so people can follow along. It'll be kind of a short one or a shorter one. Been rocking and rolling with training this week so far. I might actually throw up a picture without my lovely face in it. So sad. But I found that the front part of my body armor, or at least the neck part, if I fold it down, it serves as a lovely dining table. And the Ukrainian guys who drop off food at the training grounds find it hysterical that I'll just pile everything into one bowl and eat it because, you know, there's 200 soldiers. The lines are long. I'm not going to be able to come back for seconds. So give me that macaroni and borscht, which I guess is something of not a culinary tradition here. And hopefully that's enough time of me filling the air to actually get this up and running. Let me see if the tweets popped up, and we will have, yes, the code for tonight's map, if you'd like to follow along, is 6018 Z as in Zulu, and that's lowercase. If you haven't followed along in the past, no worries. It's a live map. We're using the fantastic application made by David Rosnow. It's free for all kinds of phones. I don't see any of your data. You just see what I'm looking at. And we're using Andrew Perpetua's map, which is from yesterday, because now I'm speaking to you 7 to 10 hours ahead from the future. And, you know, it takes even the best of us in terms of mapping. I'd say Andrew is up there. A couple hours to put things together. So that should be up in the nest. And, yeah, how are you guys doing this evening or, you know, morning, wherever you may be?
I'm excited to have you here. I have a few questions, and I don't think there's anybody better to answer it considering you're there, and I always get a good response. And when you don't know, I'm told you don't know. I'm quite excited for you to be here. I did not expect that till a couple hours ago, and I'm very excited about it. So over to you, Tracy.
All righty then. Well, in that case, let's just dive right into it, shall we? And I guess the recording's gone. Let me set a start. Okay, this is the military update for May 14th and 15th, 2024, day 811 and 812 of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Starting in Belarus and the western border, Slovakian Prime Minister Robert Fico was shot 5 times following a government meeting. Currently, he is in critical condition, undergoing a lengthy emergency surgery with reportedly significant abdominal bleeding. His shooter was reportedly politically motivated, with varying claims as to his political ideology, some allegations that he was with some more nationalist Russian-backed groups, others, you know, the theories run the gamut, so I'm not going to make a clear determination at this time. World leaders have condemned the violence, including Zelensky, Putin, and Biden, on this right-wing politician who has recently resumed power at the end of last year. And Hungary will reportedly block any EU sanctions on Russian gas, claiming a stance against anything that would raise energy prices in Europe. Moving towards Kyiv and central Ukraine, and speaking about energy, rolling emergency blackouts have commenced in Kyiv, Odessa, Dnipro, and Donetsk oblasts, including nearly stranding one of my guys in an elevator, so thankfully he decided to take the stairs. Lviv will also have blackouts beginning at midnight tonight. This is primarily driven by unseasonably cold weather across the country. I mean, it's been touching freezing weather in the past week in some places in the east here, and that's usually not what you would expect in middle of May. Ukraine intercepted 18 out of 18 Shahed suicide drones on May 14th and 0 out of 1 ballistic missiles. Ukraine reportedly has 11,000 generators allocated for its healthcare system, which is designed to have enough fuel for 5 days in reserve before it starts needing resupply. There's already a few concerns about how to make that logistic pipeline work if it becomes required. although it's good to have those discussions before you need it rather than during or, God forbid, afterwards. Zelensky has postponed or canceled all planned international events on his schedule until the stabilization of the front line, mostly Kharkiv. And Ukraine has modified its food catalog for the armed forces, seeking to reduce excess spending and improve selection. This has been the subject of some controversy in Ukraine for well over a year. There were a few high-profile events of ludicrous prices for individual fruits that were being budgeted, actually led to the resignation, I believe, prosecution of some military officers. So Ukraine is really trying to be very public about any changes in, you know, financial habits here. The U.S. will reportedly provide Ukraine with an additional $2 billion U.S. dollars in aid aimed at investing in Ukrainian military production. Russia has increased its volume of cyber attacks on Ukraine's service members' cell phones, especially with spyware and malicious software on messenger apps such as Telegram and Signal. And U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken arrived in Kyiv yesterday, where he reaffirmed U.S. support for expanding Ukrainian grain export operations, discussed pending and, you know, eventual U.S. and Ukraine bilateral security agreements, as well as played a guitar in a bar in Kyiv, which somehow attracted a ton of controversy, as if he was going to go storm a trench or something otherwise. Moving towards northeast Ukraine and Kharkiv, where we continue to see the results of an ongoing Russian incursion, Russian forces continue efforts to apparently create a buffer zone between Volchansk and Lipetsk to the west, with fighting in the forest around both residential regions. They're using what's been called cockroach tactics, or at least that's how I've had soldiers describe it to me for the last year, where the idea being they send a small group of 5 to 10 people. They don't attract enough attention to warrant a drone or artillery, especially when Ukraine has an artillery shortage. They set up shop in a building, and then they send another 5 and so on and so forth until there's enough critical mass that they can break out and actually launch some kind of assault. This is effective to some extent, but it also leads to incredibly high losses whenever they actually get engaged, because 4 to 5 people isn't enough. For reference, during evacuation processes, if you're going to pull somebody a couple kilometers and they're not using their legs, you better have at least 4 person plus that casualty. So, you know, if 1 or 2 people gets injured, it goes from a terrible situation to an outright catastrophe. And the Russian troops here don't seem to be particularly well trained, at least not the leading edge of them. Russia is known for pushing less experienced troops to the front, and then if they manage to get a toehold, reinforcing them with more experienced combat troops, mechanized forces, and so on and so forth. But the poor guys in the front don't really have a high life expectancy. To Volchansk, which has been in the news the most recently, a small town to merely like 6 kilometers away from the Russian border, Russia has further contested the northwestern aspect of it, specifically the residential region here, which has a bunch of sort of this suburban, you know, single family home area, as well as a forest, which located to the northwest. We're seeing more Russian assaults around there, more contestation of territory. There has been claims from Ukraine that they managed to fully push Russian troops out of the city. It's very unclear right now. It's all kind of a gray zone, although it has been noted that Russia has been actively targeting and detonating bridges in this area before their own troops can cross them, which leads to analyses such as the Institute for the Study of War saying Russia's goal here is not to sweep south and conquer Kharkiv with, you know, 1/10 the troops they would need. It's to create some sort of buffer zone and say, hey, Ukraine can't put artillery closer to the border. They're going to have to put more troops here, and they're not going to be able to launch raids into Belgorod as they have in the past. A little further west, we continue to see action around Staritsa, near the town of Bukhravuta. And these are very small towns existing in kind of what's called a gray zone. There's been some defenses here. To be perfectly blunt, the TDF forces here reportedly just kind of abandoned them, which has caused quite a bit of consternation among other forces saying, look, you know, while Ukrainian military forces are fighting and dying at the front lines, TDF forces on the border, especially in areas that haven't seen direct combat, have become very lax in their security protocols, and they didn't expect to get hit. So when they did, a lot of them just kind of folded. And that's what led to the emergency infusion of troops from other regions, which is also something Russia is probably trying to push so that way they can advance in those same other regions. To the northeast of Kharkiv itself, as Russia continues to bombard Kharkiv city, we see Russian forces pushing down near Khlebok as they try and push down to the town of Lipsy, aided by drone and artillery strikes. Currently, there's more fighting in the forest here. Again, the situation remains fluid and unclear, although Ukraine commanders are generally and very broadly saying the situation is stabilizing. It's not going to happen overnight. What does a stabilized situation look like here? Pushing all the way back to the border, freezing the front lines where it is, somewhere between the two. Your guess is as good as mine. But currently, it seems like the Russian forces are now actually hitting prepared defenses with troops that are willing to stand and fight, and that has put a decent bit of cold water on their forward momentum. Reportedly, Russia lost at least some 60 soldiers and 19 pieces of equipment over 10 assaults towards Kharkiv as of about 7 p.m., so 4 or 5 hours ago. Approximately 300 people remain in Volchansk as Russian raiding groups entering the northern part of the town have been increasingly engaged. And Kharkiv military officials say that all 2023 defensive line projects have been fully completed in this region, and that the recently controversially pictures of social media showing several hundred instances of dragon's teeth, those concrete polyhedrons, strewn all the way up and down the street is a single isolated incident where items were removed from defenses at a specific brigade's request. They also highlight this was less than 0.5% of all of the reinforced line, and that's, you know, not to draw conclusions from it. Russia struck a residential district in Kharkiv with missiles, wounding two men in their apartments. Meanwhile, another S-300 missile failed to detonate and terrified a bunch of people when it just slammed into the yard of an apartment building in Soltivka and was later defused. At least 12 civilians have been killed and 40 more injured in the last week in Kharkiv, primarily from Russian artillery and rocket fire. And despite alleged Russian goals, as said by Budanov in recent days, to launch an assault on Sumy Oblast further to the west, Russia has not yet created an assault group to prosecute said goals. While there has been an increased number of Russian recon units operating along the border in Sumy for several months now, they don't seem to have the combined forces planned and prepared to actually launch an offensive here, because you can't just turn around, wake everybody up and say, hey, it's 6 a.m., it's 7 a.m., we're pushing the border. Not if you hope to see any of them again. However, Ukrainian forces say they're monitoring the situation, especially the intelligence services, and if and when Russia decides to pivot from a Kharkiv push towards a Sumy push, they will be able to better accurately identify targeted locations and reinforce them. Russia also, even further west, targeted a fire station in Chernihiv with drones, the latest in a long line of targeting emergency infrastructure. Moving towards Kupiansk and Liman in the east, Ukraine repelled some 28 attacks over the past day in the Kupiansk direction, with Russian and Ukrainian drone strikes notably increasing to the northeast of Kupiansk. It appears that Russia is taking another play at Sinkivka to the northeast of Kupiansk. This position, very much reinforced by Ukraine, especially with extensive minefields, has not really changed any territory for well over a year now. What we have been seeing is Russian forces operating in the forest belt to the northwest, the small micro-village of Liman Pershi. However, because there's only a limited number of active roads here, they've been getting eviscerated by Ukrainian drones for well over 6 months now, haven't seen any major change. Moving further to the southeast, along the main highway, down from Kupiansk towards Svatov, there has been some Russian gains. Specifically contesting additional territory in the fields here near the small town of Miazorivka. However, you know, frankly, I don't know a huge amount about this area. It's battles between forest belt strips and a relatively stagnant front. Moving even further southeast down towards Kremina, as Russian forces here who have sought long to push into the Zarubets River Valley, specifically Terny through this forest belt, haven't experienced any forward momentum, despite being a mere 2 kilometers from the town, aided by airstrikes. For about a month and a half now, the most direct route has not been successful for Russian forces. So they've tried to expand the front line, primarily to the north. That also hasn't been super successful. And the more Russian forces try and expand the front line, the more they have to dilute their forces. And it seems like things start to stagnate yet again. We saw only 2 attacks out of Kremina and towards the forest today, as opposed to the 28 attacks further to the northwest, which is a stunning reversal, where usually we've seen Russian forces actually rotated from areas closer to Kupiansk down towards Kremina. It seems that Russia is just trying to position itself to strike somewhere, get a breakthrough somewhere, especially when Ukrainian forces are forced to redeploy and ammo shortages abound. Moving down towards Kramatorsk and the Bakhmut region, first around Seversk, Russian strikes in the fields east of Seversk have notably increased, mostly around Bilharivka. There's sort of this industrial zone there that's been broadly leveled over the last 2 years. Russian strikes in recent weeks have picked up. Not a huge amount of change on the ground here that anybody's been able to observe. We have seen some 10 assaults over the last day. Russia launched 9 strikes to the west, 9 assaults to the west of Bakhmut in recent day, with some additional contesting of territory near Ivanivsky, aided by significant drone presence, 9 assaults here. About 670 people remain in Chasiv Yar, with most of the population evacuated towards Kyiv or further to the west. We continue to see Russian forces striking into the eastern suburb of Kanal, which lies across, what you might have guessed, a canal. Sits at a pretty lower elevation compared to the rest of Chasiv Yar, especially the high rises in the eastern part of the town, which allow Ukrainian troops fire control over it. Russia is predictably trying to glide bomb everything out of existence, but thus far have not been able to make any notable advancements per local commanders in the region through canal or the forest belts to its north or south. And over the last day, Russia shelled Donetsk just under 2,000 times. Moving down towards Avdiivka and Pokrovsk, Russia continues to heavily focus in this area, launching 31 assaults to the west of Avdiivka. The front lines do not appear to have materially changed in the last 48 hours, while Russian forces initially having staged a breakthrough from Osheritne up to Arkhangelsk appear to have also stagnated in their approach there. Ukraine did admit that they withdrew from Osheritne to allegedly better defensive positions. The status of Ukraine defensive positions here has been a subject of much griping among the Ukraine military community, both for good reasons and for not so good reasons. There's a lack of, or was a lack of, prepared defensive positions prior to the fall of Avdiivka. This comes down to everything from logistics issues to antiquated protocols for requisitioning things like concrete and wood, to just the simple fact that they need more excavators and such in order to dig these things. You can't dig it all by hand. And also, it's tantamount to suicide to try and dig massive trenches while you're under artillery bombardment or drone strikes, which means by that point, it's too late and you're just in a ditch and you have to deal with it. So where ultimate defensive lines will be, can't tell you, but my hypothesis is going to be along the natural barriers here. At worst, there is a river system further to the west with hills and whatnot, which historically we've seen those become the front lines here in the absence of otherwise prepared defenses. And Ukraine arrested 6 Russian agents in Pokrovsk who had been coordinating double-tap missile strikes in the city, causing casualties among both civilians and rescue personnel. Moving down towards Donetsk and the occupied regions in general, Russia launched some 20 assaults to the northwest and southwest of Marinka, continuing to contest territory in Krasnohorivka in the south and east, more of an industrial southern portion, the residential region being more to the north. Russia is also reportedly deploying additional morgues to Lugansk to store bodies and not overwhelm local mortuary services in Belgorod Oblast, especially with the increase in assaults around Kupiansk and the Kharkiv offensive. This isn't exactly new for Russia. It's something they famously did in Syria during the aftermath of a major loss when Wagner mercenaries attacked a U.S. base at Conoco Field, suffered some 300 casualties. Russia placed the bodies on ice in Damascus at that point and then staggered releasing them back to their families so as not to cause a PR disaster. In Zaporizhia and the southern axis, Russia launched 22 assaults towards Staromayorsk and Robotne, while Russian forces claimed to have seized into Robotne. Doesn't appear to have been the case. Ukraine say that there's no credence to these claims, drawing reference to these previous short-lived assaults, some of them being basically thunder runs into the middle of the town in a car, dropping a flag, and then the group that did so basically all gets massacred, but not before a drone can, you know, take a picture and say, look, we have a flag there, and then warn about information operations. Ukraine, or rather Russia, launched some 268 strikes on six settlements across the southern line today, 94 times with drones and 164 times with artillery. Additionally, striking Dnipro with a missile, killing two people at an infrastructure site. Moving to the west, towards Kherson, Russia launched five assaults towards the bridgehead at Krynki, which remains unchanged. Ukrainian drone strikes continue, especially to the southwest of Krynki, along the Kanka River itself, where we continue to see targeting of the Russian forces who are seeking to oust the Ukrainian troops. There continues to be contestation of territory in the southwest river delta from Kherson itself. The specific situation here, incredibly unclear, but it does seem like there's competing raiding parties over these tiny little marshes, which are, you know, they're less than 10 or 20 feet above sea level before the dam burst. So where they're at now is probably not any more of a place you want to dig trenches. Moving to Crimea, Odessa, and the Black Sea, Ukraine reportedly struck the Belbek Air Base in Crimea multiple times with ATACMS or other long-range missiles, destroying two S-300 or S-400 batteries, one of their long-range radar systems, a fuel depot, and damaging multiple aircraft. Russia has continued to not deploy ships to the Black Sea for about a week now. And Ukraine military recruiter allegedly beat the hell out of a woman in Odessa on video, and the Ministry of Defense of Ukraine has promised an investigation following public uproar. In Russia itself, Russia arrested the head of its Ministry of Defense personnel department under allegations of corruption. Russia's Ministry of Internal Affairs has claimed there is a shortfall of about 152,000 Russian policemen, or about 20% of all the policemen in Russia. Moscow is allegedly understaffed by almost 75%. Additionally, there continues to be an ongoing need for about 30,000 doctors across the country. And Ukrainian drones hit a Russian oil depot in Rostov overnight. In general, over the last day, Ukrainian troops conducted about 12 airstrikes, while Russian forces conducted 114 airstrikes, including drones, and 84 rocket artillery strikes. Yesterday, Ukrainian troops eliminated some 1,510 soldiers for a total of 484,040, daily average of 1,359. There's 48 armored vehicles, 14 tanks, 23 artillery systems, four of which were rocket artillery, 48 cars and trucks and 30 UAVs for an estimated cost of $84.6 million. Overseas, the Parliament of Estonia passed a law that allows the use of frozen Russian assets to compensate for Ukrainian damages. Australia will provide additional river combat boats to Ukraine in its next aid package. The U.S. is reportedly considering sending another Patriot battery and radars to Ukraine. And Croatia will help Ukraine to mining territories following a bilateral agreement signed. The Ministry of Defense of Estonia stated that the idea of sending military personnel to Ukraine has not gained any development either at Estonia's level or the level of the EU, following some reports yesterday that Estonia was examining options. Joe Biden signed a law banning the import of uranium from Russia as Washington seeks to reduce its dependence on Russian nuclear fuel. However, there are numerous loopholes until 2028. And Georgia, the country, has reportedly passed its controversial foreign influence law, which has been derided as a Russian-backed suppression measure amid heavy protests. With that, that should be about it. If there's any questions, I'm happy to stick around for a little bit.
Thank you so much. That was brilliant. Anybody got any questions? Now's your chance to come up and ask them, because language has not got a lot of time with us today. So don't keep him hanging around. Jump up to the panel, press that microphone button, and come and have a chat to us. Aria, you said you had some questions for language.
Yep. So in the meantime, and please, if you do have any questions, feel free to ask them. There are not bad questions unless you are just parroting propaganda or you're, you know, going on a monologue, which isn't a question. So language, I have two questions for you. The first one is, I've seen some people throw around the idea that you know, the Russians don't think they can take Kharkiv. And they're not even necessarily sure they can hold the villages they're taking. And I've seen some people speculate that this may be to relieve pressure on areas that are a priority to them. Do you think there is credibility to that? Or do you think that they're actually trying to push as far as they can? And that this is something that they think they can, you know, tackle, not necessarily taking Kharkiv, but making significant gains in the area, and being able to fortify or hold those. And then the second question is, how do you feel the morale is both behind the lines and with people going to the front or who have come back from the front that you have talked to or seen? Within the last week, I know I had asked you that the last time we talked, and that I think was around a week ago. So if we could get an update on that, I would greatly appreciate it. Thank you.
I'm terribly sorry. It kind of cut out at the beginning. I'm happy to give you an update on what was it exactly. Just was it was like my experiences here, or was it something else? It cut out for a second there at the beginning.
If you think the advance,
The advance. Yes, I'm so sorry.
Is a legitimate one, or
I'd say no. Yeah, not to cut you off, but the short answer is no. The long answer is no, because they don't have enough equipment. I've been pretty public, I think, and so maybe this is me just sticking to my guns because I don't want to be wrong, but I think I have good reason to believe it, that it's functionally impossible for Russia to take Kharkiv. They couldn't do it in the first week of the war. They're not going to do it now when they've lost a huge amount of equipment and now there's drones. Not without ludicrously more equipment than they would need. Somebody was saying that there was 50,000 troops arranged across the northeastern border. Granted, there's a lot of nuances in that. But even beyond that, they have like a quarter of the armored vehicles they need if they want to take everything they had and push. So Russia is not that stupid. So it seems more likely they have two objectives. I've talked with a few folks out there. One is to create kind of a buffer zone. I think ISW has been talking about that. They're basically just burning everything northeast of or northwest of Volchansk and some areas to the west of it. The idea, like they're just allegedly destroying bridges that they haven't crossed yet, which generally isn't a good idea if you want to cross them in the future. However, it's a pretty decent idea if you want to say, hey, this gray zone, this area that's not really inhabited by folks that had some sort of shoddy defensive positions that got abandoned, nobody's going to be here anymore. We're going to mine the hell out of it. We're going to fire artillery at everything that moves, and we've blown the bridges to it. So good luck sending more RDK incursions into Belgorod. That actually works pretty well. You don't need a ton of forces to do it. You just need a big strike, blow a couple things, scare some people, and hold on with whatever you have. And if you have to pull back, like Ukraine has done with these RDK incursions, then you go, well, we've accomplished our objectives, right? Especially if you mine the hell out of it, and Russia is known for doing that. The other more frightening, and I think maximalist objective would be the technical term, the goal that Russia has in a perfect world, is advancing conventional artillery within 25 kilometers of Kharkiv and resuming a bombardment of the city. That could be very bad if it were allowed to happen. Thus far, Russia has quite a ways to go. They're continuing to bombard Kharkiv pretty much the same way they have in the past with S-300 ballistic missiles and otherwise. And Ukrainian forces, it's no secret, have been redeployed into that breach in Lipsky. I believe the 42nd Brigade or the 44th is currently there.
And then I think some elements of the 92nd or 93rd as well. So they've got pushed in. There will surely be discussion about the role of territorial defense units, standardization, holding defenses, so on and so forth in the aftermath of this. But the general sentiment I've heard is that when the Russians are actually encountering some of these prepared defensive positions, which Kharkiv does have, they were actually the first oblast independently start raising taxes, which was a whole big political thing, to build these themselves. Then the Ukrainian national government got involved, started rolling out a project, allocated about $500 million, a little bit more, to all the oblasts to do this sort of work. And defensive positions work when you build them and you staff them. So that's pretty decent. It's just a matter of having the trained troops willing to stay there under a initially withering artillery bombardment, especially if they haven't seen combat action for several months. I expect they're going to put, it's going to probably peter out in the next couple of days. What happens after that? I got no clue. I think it depends on how much Russian forces are able to entrench, how much resources they devote there versus, say, trying to pivot towards Sumy. While they do have troops at the border, they're not currently in an assault formation. That will take a couple of days. Yeah, Sumy, maybe in the next week, maybe less, maybe more, maybe never. Who knows? But the hope is that any troops that may be in Sumy, territorial defense troops especially, have a little bit more time to dig in, and also that they'll have more advance warning of where Russian forces will be coming from if such an attack does take place. Especially in Sumy, there's been a decent bit of raiding from Russian forces, so-called DRGs or recon forces, over the last several months. It's a lot easier to hit positions that aren't expecting you with troops that aren't prepared for you than troops that go, oh, this is happening now, and are ready and at least willing to stay underneath the initial artillery bombardment. Beyond that, we'll have to see. But while the situation in Kharkiv is certainly not great, I wouldn't, you know, necessarily believe some of the claims being spread online that, you know, you're going to have Russian troops marching through the largest military square in Europe anytime soon.
So thank you very much, Language. I think we lost Arie, so he will be back with us in a moment. Actually, I was thinking about the defences when you were talking about that, because I've seen lots of videos this week. I guess they're being publicised for obvious reasons, for the public messaging to show people. They seem quite extensive to me, but obviously I'm no expert to judge these. I've seen some videos about the ones in Kharkiv and Zaporizhia, and interestingly, as you mentioned, the money being rolled out in the administrations to fund those.
Yeah, I've seen a couple. These were more in Kyiv, in areas around the city that I had trained troops in, which, frankly, this time last year were glorified sand pits in the ground. They hadn't been reinforced since the battle for Kyiv, and they were in a pretty sorry state. Now you've got actual pillboxes, you've got prepared firing positions, you've got small anti-vehicle trenches. You've actually got the workings of something that doesn't look like it was dug with hand tools. And that's a big improvement. It doesn't take a whole heck of a lot to make something from a trench that's terrifying to be in to a trench that you, it's not going to feel comfortable, but you also are going to feel much more protected against things like drones and artillery, especially if before you just had a few pieces of wood and plastic and some dirt on top. So I'm not going to comment on any defensive positions around Sumy, Kharkiv, or Chernihiv oblasts, but based on the experience I've seen and changes in the last 6 months since I've been here in around Kyiv, I've got to expect that there's at least a couple of those bunkers there too. Then it just comes down to, are the troops ready, willing, and able to staff them and sustain there under what would likely be an initially withering artillery bombardment, drones, and so forth, and hold their positions, because it might suck pushing a trench. It sucks a lot more when that trench is concrete. So, you know, that's my read on the matter, my personal opinion, as it were.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, and I appreciate you not saying other things that you think is not good, a good idea to. The only videos I've seen have been ones that have been released officially, of course, from Ukrainian government. So they're obviously not going to show us anything that's going to be a risk for operational security. But it's good to know that you have seen those develop, because, as you say, it's really important that they have the right amount of trenches. I've noticed as well with the intensity and the increase all across the front line, the amount of combat clashes taking place over the day, it's absolutely staggering. Even when we went to 133 clashes per day, I thought that was pretty staggering. But now I'm noticing the last few days, the general staff are putting out reports every couple of hours rather than once or twice a day as they used to. And each one of those is mentioning really high levels of attacks in each area. So over the course of the day, it really is absolutely mind-boggling, I think. I just wonder if you can speak about that at all for listeners to understand the insights.
Sure. So again, kind of getting back to those cockroach tactics I was talking about, when we say that an assault, that doesn't mean 100, it may, but it doesn't usually mean 100 Russian troops supported by, you know, helicopters and jets and tanks screaming by, you know, the Russian anthem blares in the distance. Not so much, because it takes a lot of time to put those troops together. It takes a lot of time to put those tanks together. It takes a lot of time to set the loudspeakers up in that hypothetical. And Ukraine is starved for artillery ammo, but it's not that starved. If you put 20 tanks together in a line, they're going to get hit. If you put 5 tanks together, they're going to get hit, especially in the era of drone warfare, where you can immobilize a tank and then start pivoting a longer range artillery onto it. It's, you got to have a real reason to do it. So Russia doesn't. What they do is they lead with these cockroach tactic style, strikes, 5, 10, maybe 20 guys. They started pioneering this really around Bakhmut, which is why I'm surprised that I'm seeing Western media saying, oh, this is a brand new tactic around Kharkiv. It's been going on for well over a year and a half now. They push them forward. Sometimes they don't even really have weapons, and people deride that, but in certain areas it makes sense. They just send them with a ton of ammunition. Like, they'll just say, you don't need rifles or anything. You're just carrying 500 rounds of ammunition, and you're going into that basement, get there and wait. And then they'll send another couple guys, and then they'll say, okay, you've got huge amounts of ammo, tons of grenades, rockets, whatever. Sit there and shoot anything that moves. Okay, we've got something of a bridge here, a bridgehead. Now we're actually going to send conventional Russian military forces, not Stormzy. Okay, they've got something. They're setting up a control, you know, site here. Okay, now we're actually going to send mechanized forces, or now we're going to send actually trained VDV, or so on and so forth. And they try and sort of break through that way. However, this only works if that front line, or that initial wave, if you will, is successful. So you don't want to be in that, to be sure, because that can be, it doesn't tend to work very well. If they do manage to get a foothold somewhere, then it can get very rough, because as this sort of wave builds up, if you will, it goes from 5 guys that you didn't care enough about. You said, oh, well, the troops on the ground can deal with them, we're not going to use artillery, to now you've got 50, 60, 70 guys all stocked, ammoed. That's not a word, but you know what I mean. And with mechanized and artillery support, except now instead of having to cross a kilometer to get to you, they only have to cross 150 meters. That's a real problem. And that's where you start to see these breakthroughs occur. But, you know, I think recently the reason the general staff is reporting it, 100% to do with Kharkiv. There is understandably a fairly large level of concern about that. This is Russia launching an assault from the northern border for the first time in over 2 years. That's worthy of concern, and towards Ukraine's second largest city. That's not a good thing. And if Ukraine general staff were mum on it, it would probably open the doors to a huge amount of panic, because information operations, I haven't really been looking at Twitter much the past couple of days, but I'm sure there's been some pretty wild takes there. And anybody who's heard me talk about him knows I am very much not a fan of General Sirski's past military history, and I've been one of his more loud detractors. And even I have to admit that his openness and the openness of his staff here, saying, look, this situation is bad, this is where we expect things to go, and we don't expect to be successful in everything, but we're going to keep you updated. I'd rather a I'd rather a harsh truth than a comforting lie. And I think that's the right method here. So that might be a shock for some people who are used to or perhaps have consciously avoided negative news in the past. I'd recommend you don't do that, because if all you do is listen to fairy tales, when the real world comes knocking, it'll knock you on your ass. But I think it's the right move going forward, and I will trust the general staff and their updates here to a point. You know, you have to use some common sense. But does that answer your question? And then some about, you know, the 100+ assaults a day we're seeing. It's not like, you know, there's not tanks involved in all of them. It's generally light infantry, you know, searching for opportunities to break through, which would then later be exploited.
Absolutely, it does. Thank you so much. And I'm really, that's fantastic that you say that about Sersky, because if he can really give you that opinion when you were a little bit negative about him, as you say yourself.
Well, I wasn't a little bit. I was a lot bit negative. And, I'm still, it's going to take a while before I start, you know, relenting on that one. But I will give credit when and where credit is due. So, you know, I'm not exactly a cheerleader just yet, but he has drastically outperformed my expectations, which admittedly were rock bottom.
I appreciate that, but it's good to know, isn't it? Because, like you say, if he's open to that and he's admitting where the problems are, then that's kind of like the first step, as you say, and at least he's been honest about them and trying to fix them. And I think that can only be good moving forward. Just an update for everybody before we go on to Hans. I thought you may all like to know that there seems to be some activity at Belbeck Airfield again. There are videos coming out now. It seems to be on fire. Oh dear, what a shame. Poor Belbeck Airfield, not. And also there's noise in Sevastopol. It's loud there. And it seems the Crimean Bridge is closed. Go ahead, Untel fella.
Thank you very much, Language. Language Learner, you are the first Twitter feed that I check every single morning when I wake up. And I pray for you, my brother.
Well, you really don't have to check every day. I'm only doing these updates twice a week, so you can save yourself some doom scrolling at least 5 days out of it, hopefully. I kid.
Okay. I got a little worried there when I didn't hear from you. I figured you were busy. But I always here waiting with you for you guys to with open arms for you. My question, very quickly. I know you're very short on time. Would you be able to speak of Russian desertion rates? Have we seen that spiked up? Are there any operations or mechanisms in place to receive these possible deserters? Are we pushing out propaganda? Do we have like a 1-800 line that we can reach out? And how long or how high, how strong are the efforts to try to get these Russian invaders to basically give up and turn themselves into Ukrainian forces? Thank you.
Sure. So I think there's a lot of effusive praise there. You're too kind. As far as Russian desertion rates, I don't have any updates on like numbers there. That's just not something I'm keyed into. Ukraine did more recently open another POW camp, I believe it was, in Western Ukraine. They were talking about it a week and a half ago. So there's some need for that in a capacity. One can imagine why or why not. Although, look, in the way this modern warfare, you're not seeing your opponent a lot of times. Yes, you can surrender to drones. I've worked with units who have done it repeatedly. In fact, the 109th Battalion of the 10th Brigade has a particular affinity for it, and then playing really gut-wrenching music over it, like In the Arms of an Angel or something. I guess, you know, kind of highlight the humanity of it all. But generally, like if you're storming a trench, you're not, I hate to say it, like I'm sure that I'll have a lawyer here after me. It's very hard to surrender to the grenade that just rolled into your bunker. I'll leave it at that. And if you're assaulting a trench, it's very difficult to surrender as you burst into around a corner towards a guy aiming a rifle at you. Nobody speaks that fast, not even me. And surrendering to an artillery shell is equally ineffective. So that does play an effect into it. What's happening around Kharkiv, who knows? Again, smaller groups tending to get devastated in place. Is it possible there'll be some Increased surrenders, sure. I don't think that anything that's currently going on is going to lead to a major change one way or the other, just because this is not a warfare where you have the ability to really reach out and talk to your opponent or offer your surrender to them. You're usually dying or being wounded by something multiple kilometers away. Unfortunately, I just don't have any information beyond that.
Thank you very much.
No problem. Thank you very much for that. I appreciate it.
Thank you, fellow language.
Go ahead, Arian.
Thank you very much, language, for your time here. I would ask everybody who is not following currently Language Learner to please do so. His updates and posts are definitely worth following. And while I don't check it every day, I definitely do take a regular look at them. I would like to also thank everybody who's been here with us for the last hour. I know, Language, you had said you were rushed on time and you ended up staying quite a long time. So we really, from the bottom of our heart, appreciate it. If there's anything you'd like to add, otherwise we'll let you get on your way. I know it's a bit later and you're in the future over there. Back to you.
Yeah, I mean, look, if there's one thing I've seen here, and if frankly, I'd expect us folks, the situation sucks, okay? But, man, this is just my personal opinion. It sucked for a while. It sucked last year in different ways than it does now. But if you kind of wrap your head around the fact that this is going to be a long war, and it's war, it's an awful, terrible thing where people do horrific things to each other, and there's tremendous amounts of sadness and misery. If you treat it like that, rather than, and I'm not accusing anyone here of doing it, although frankly I have seen some wild takes on Twitter, don't treat it like a team sport, like, oh, my team's winning, my team's losing. Be like, this is a problem that in an industrial scale that we're trying to fix. It's a lot easier to push through. Like, I'm not going to turn around and fix Kharkiv tomorrow. It's impossible. I go insane. But what I can do is say, I'm going to train XYZ amount of soldiers in something that's statistically going to save 1-3% more of their life. And by virtue of that, I have accomplished something today. That works for me, doesn't have to work for you. You don't have to care one bit about it. But if your thing is saving cats in Kherson, go for it. If you are supporting it, or frankly, even just talking to people around the water cooler, you don't need to be that guy or girl at the office, but be like, hey, you know, there's still a war going on, right? One of the largest wars in 70 years. And you have to read the news. Might be something, just you find your little niche, stay in that. Don't burn yourself out. I mean, look, not to be rude, but if you have the opportunity to turn the news off for a couple of days because it's getting to you, go right ahead and do that. That's a luxury some people can't afford. Don't feel guilty about it. Go and take that mental break. I know several people in Kyiv who are actively searching for psychologists, local Ukrainian nationals, because this is traumatizing stuff. And, take the time you can, because if you burn yourself out on it just by, oh, I have to consume all the misery and horror and pain, well, congrats, you have made yourself miserable. You are now ineffective at whatever you're trying to do before, and the world has one more miserable person in it. That's helping nobody, least of all yourself. So, find something you're passionate about. Maybe your passions change. Cool. That's fine. Stick with it and take some time for yourself, especially if you have that capability. And, war is not going anywhere. It'll be here when you get back. That's I'll get down off my soapbox, but that's sort of my feel, especially now with a little more panic rolling around with everything around Kharkiv, which personally, for a variety of reasons, I'm not exactly throwing in the towel just yet.
Thank you very much, Language. That's some really great insights and some very good points that you make there. It's going to be bad for a long time, isn't it? And we all have to kind of accept that. I've noticed, actually, the military administration in Kharkiv is making lots of posts and reports about the psychological operations that you talk about and all the stuff around on social media. So I think it's very good to highlight that. And I just wonder, actually, seeing as you mentioned your training, if you'd like to tell us about that at all. How's that going?
It's going well. It's a learning process. It's a different unit than I had worked with in the past. And kind of getting back into the swing of things has been, admittedly, from the jump, a bit of a challenge. I had different expectations. I thought I could just copy paste stuff. Doesn't work that way for a variety of technical reasons. There's also some resource limitations and whatnot, but you know, necessity is the mother of invention. And there's some really phenomenal people here, and I'll talk to them a bit more if that's something they're interested in being more public about. Happy to share more information, but until that time, I'm sure you understand, I simply won't. So it's not just me. There are other fine people who've been doing this for quite a while. Some names you may recognize, some names you may not, but that's their story to tell, not mine. Things are going well. Iterative training. I was not at all confident in some of the guys that we were working with at the beginning. Frankly, I was pretty bemused, and that led to me just pushing them harder because I know they can do more. That doesn't work. You know, bull in a china shop approach is not the way to teach some people things. But now, especially in the last two days, some of these guys are at levels that I would say is appropriate for the situations they're going to experience. And a number of them, I'm not going to say we've become friends. You know, frankly, I can barely remember their names. They're all named Sergio or Ivan or Igor or, you know, Dima or whatever, right? You know, some of them are good guys who I – not good as in the rest are bad, but some of them are good enough that I would really trust them with my life in this narrow spectrum of emergency medical care if, you know, something were to happen. Others need more practice, but it's good to see that change. It's good to see that development. That's what puts a twinkle in my eye and a spring in my step, saying, hey, this is where you were a week ago, a day ago, an hour or two ago, and this is where you are now. Look at how much you've changed. Look at what you know. When this happens for real, you ain't got to panic because you know it and you know the guy next to you knows it. So if one of you gets injured, this is just old tricks by now. You've done tourniquets XYZ amount of times. You've done evacuations 1, 2, 3 amount of times. This isn't new. This should be boring because good medicine in emergency situations is boring as the situation itself is chaos. So I'm feeling pretty good. Sleep deprived, eating a ton of food. You know, I wish there was more hot sauce out here, but that's a small pea problem. And just sort of figuring out, you know, necessities, the little fires that keep popping up and need to get put out. But otherwise, kind of enjoying the cold weather. I thought I had left that behind in Colorado and it was going to be steaming, but apparently not. So I'm actually I'm feeling pretty decent, all things considered. Although that might just be me running off, you know, sort of a second wind here at the end of the night as we approach midnight.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. And I'm glad to know that it's going really well for you. So it's definitely good news. So, Aria, anything to add?
No, I just greatly appreciate your time language and I appreciate the update. You've given me a lot of information to think on. And I learned a lot today. So I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, thank you, guys. I appreciate the kind words. I hope you guys have a wonderful evening and take care. I'll throw the audio and text up later.
Thank you so much. We hope you get a good night's sleep, language. I'm sure you deserve it.